Good morning. Can you smell it? Can you? Because we are within sniffing distance of the end of level 5. Or are we? Because our progress has shuddered to a halt.
We were declining very rapidly. We had a reproduction number as low as 0.6. But over the last week, we've seen relatively stable case numbers. So that means we're going to see a higher reproduction number. So reproduction number has increased from the estimate that we gave last week. The remaining estimates give us a reproduction number somewhere between 0.7 and 0.9. And a lot depends on what happens over the next few days to a week in terms of whether that reproduction number will reach or go above 1. So that increase in reproduction number is a significant cause for concern.
NPHET's Philip Nolan as heard on Thursday's Drive Time. Earlier on Morning Ireland, Áine asked science correspondent George Lee if he knew why we were seeing this stagnation.
We don't fully know why. It's not clear from the numbers why. Now, NPHET has more numbers, much more numbers than anything that's published, so they may be able to get down to the bottom of it. We do know that when you look at the information we have on clusters, which is published once a week, that has shown a very significant increase in the number of clusters during the week up until the ending, I think it was the week ending Saturday midnight. And it was an increase from just over 400 in households, private houses, to 935 in a week. So we know from the report from HICWA yesterday that it's in private households and in houses and in homes where this thing particularly spreads.
So households seem to be the problem. Well, on the same programme, Professor of Infectious Diseases Sam McConkie had a theory as to the timing.
The data we see from last week really reflect our behaviour about 2 weeks earlier, and there's some suggestion maybe over Halloween there was essentially more socialising and partying than we had before. So the optimist in me hopes that things will improve next week and the week after, because we're now back to sort of normal life, as it were, and the numbers, you know, may go down to hopefully half, maybe sort of 100 to 200 cases per day by the beginning of December. Mm-hmm. And the challenge then will be keeping it there, keeping it down, and I think that's a really important challenge. None of us want this oscillating up and down.
So the COVID fancy dress parties, well, where does that now leave us for Christmas and the new year?
This is the issue that everybody is grappling with at the moment. The current modelling would suggest that if we got to 50 to 100 in early December and we eased restrictions then, what does the mathematical modelling show? My understanding is it shows we could be up at 1,000 cases by the end of January in that situation.
It depends. It depends how much relaxation we do. It seems to me at level 3, where essentially indoor dining and pubs are not open, that may keep things somehow level. It seems to me if we go down to level 2 that hasn't controlled things in the past. So if we can sort of do the same level 3 as we've done in Ireland in the past, then that is a temporary way of keeping things level. It in my view, it's much easier to keep things very low if they start at a very low level, because then each and every outbreak in Ireland can be really thoroughly investigated. We have the staff, we have the IT systems, the resources to really thoroughly control every outbreak. Whereas at present, as you know, there's about 100 outbreaks a day, and that's too many and overwhelms our public health staff to really do a meticulous, thorough job on every single outbreak, because we simply don't have enough staff and resources to trace those backwards and forwards meticulously to prevent all onward transmission from each outbreak.
Professor Sam McConkie on Thursday's Morning Ireland. And yesterday, Mary Wilson asked HSE executive Paul Reid how they felt about those rising numbers.
We are still at close on 400 testing positive per day, stubbornly high, still too high, and now stuck. Do you believe that it is possible to get to this, I suppose it's being called this magic number of 100, to enable an opening up now in less than 2 weeks' time?
Yeah, first of all, I don't believe there is a magic number, and I know that government haven't set a magic number of 100, but we do want to get it down further. And I think if you take the 4 weeks gone past, we've made good progress. Reduction of cases overall, positivity rate down, the R value is down, people have reduced their contacts, but certainly you're right, last week it just seemed to freeze And we're working behind the scenes to see what actually we can interpret from all of that. But in the meantime, it is about maximising the next 2 weeks. And I'm confident if we do all get back to the basics and keep the basics going, like we just spoke there in your opening, we can make further progress. And yeah, it is imperative that we do.
And in your view, make further progress to where? What do you anticipate come December?
Well, what we really need to do is get it down to not just a much lower level, but to a sustainable lower level. And from our perspective in the HSE, what we need exactly is what we need is for our lower transmission levels in the community, reducing the risk to people for hospitalisations, reducing the risk to our staff contracting it and having outbreaks in hospitals and healthcare settings and nursing homes. So that's from a HSE perspective where we really want to get to.
The HSE's Paul Reid on Morning Ireland yesterday, so no magic number. But if we are looking at numbers based on a behaviour of 2 weeks ago, where are we going to be in 2 weeks' time based on last weekend's shenanigans? Well, who knows? Because the start of the week brought us a hangover, fuelled by takeaway pints. Audio recorded on South William Street in Dublin City Centre as heard on the Claire Byrne Show on Monday. A good time, certainly, but the sound of level 5? And while not necessarily breaking the letter of the law, it did seem to be somewhat at odds with the spirit. Wedding planner Tara Fay had posted the video on her Twitter account on behalf of a friend.
I was sent that video by a friend who has a business on South William Street, who was just, I think, just soul destroyed to see that happening when they have a closed business. I think people, unless they're directly affected, and this is not just in Dublin, I think this is happening all over the country, unless people are directly affected by closure, the hospitality industry, like, is closed. I don't think people actually understand the knock-on effect. Like, wedding industry, for example, musicians have not worked in months. You know, all of the little industries around that are directly affected by the closure. And this, and for them to see that video, it is like a slap in the face to them.
Ooh, strong words. And all day long, there were mutterings about what government should do. Might Health Minister Stephen Donnelly bring a memo to Cabinet to ban takeaway pints? Was there an appetite for more restrictions? Would they work? And should the rest of the country pay for bad behaviour by those in the big smoke? Well, Kerry TD Michael Healy-Ray spoke to Sarah on Drive Time.
I'm disappointed with the actions of a small number of people over last weekend. I don't like it. I'm not happy that it happened. But having said that, I want to remind the Cabinet that this is Ireland. It is not Moscow. We have to have a situation here whereby we want to protect people's health. But at the same time, we cannot bring in new legislation for every event that will happen at different locations throughout the country. A very small number of people, what I would call misbehaved and congregated in a way that they shouldn't have, behaved in a way they shouldn't have. But at the end of the day, people are tired. You mentioned it yourself, and so did Micheál Lehan. People are tired of restrictions. They're tired from being prohibited from all the things that we want to do. But we respect that. We respect what the government are trying to do on one hand. But what we want them to do is we want them to use a common sense. We want them to use the brains that God gave them, and we want them to ensure that we don't overreact situation that happened.
Michael Healy-Ray on Monday's Drive Time. But just before midday on Tuesday, having spent most of the first hour of the programme discussing this issue, a somewhat frustrated Claire Byrne brought us this.
Some news for you from RT's Micheál Lehan. The proposal to fine people gathering outdoors to drink alcohol has been withdrawn by the Cabinet. The memo brought by the Health Minister had been instigated by the Department of the Taoiseach. It was finalised last night with consultations with the AG, but there were severe reservations expressed by some Fine Gael and Green Party ministers at this morning's Cabinet meeting. So it's gone. It's gone. It's over. It's finished, it would seem, according to Micheál Lehan. I don't know why we're told about these things 14 hours ago and then they vanish into the ether, not even a full day later.
Gone maybe, but not quite forgotten. Later, Cormac O'Hara spoke to the Minister of Health, Stephen Donnelly, who said that instead of new restrictions, they were going to liaise with Gardaí to ensure they had enough resources to enforce the existing restrictions.
So just clarify for me then, what are you asking the Garda Commissioner to enforce again, particularly around street drinking this time? Because I understand that you are allowed to meet another household under level 5 restrictions outdoors, isn't that right?
You are, but not to go drinking with them, right? So the regulations say stay at home unless there is a reasonable excuse. And then there's a list of reasonable excuses. And for any of your listeners, they can go on to gov.ie and see those. And it's the ones we all know.
So coffee, okay. Irish coffee, no.
Coffee, okay, because you could be going for a walk, you could be on your way to work, you could be on your way to college, mm-hmm. you could be going to visit a parent who is ill.
You can meet another household for a coffee, is that right?
You can meet another household outside, but it's for one of the reasons that have been listed.
Yeah,
so,
but not for an Irish coffee. Isn't that patently absurd?
I think, Cormac, what is absurd is the idea that the country goes into level 5. A lot of people lose their jobs. A lot of people feel very isolated and very scared. People are making huge sacrifices. People are losing their businesses. The benefit of all of that sacrifice is we have had the biggest reduction in COVID anywhere in Europe. We're doing incredibly well. I think what would be absurd is to ask the people to make those sacrifices and achieve that progress and then say, however, it's okay for hundreds of people to get together on the streets and drink pints being served out of pubs.
So, coffee good, Irish coffee? Not so good. Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly on Tuesday's drive time. But on Friday morning, it wasn't a case of outdoor pints or a beverage with a drop in. More a case of bunch up for the shot when RTE presenters were photographed side by side with a colleague at a retirement event. Apologies by RTE and the presenters were issued, but callers into Liveline articulated what they felt were double standards. Here's Mary and then Albert.
What I couldn't believe was the hypocrisy of it. I'm to set a bit of a background, I'm in recovery from a major surgery, mm-hmm. just home since earlier this week, where I couldn't have any of my family visit me in hospital. And why do these people think they're special, that they can have this going away due for this lady, and not taken away from this lady's service or anything by any means? But why is it okay for them to break the rules and the rest of us are supposed to be adhering to the guidelines? You know, I just feel they should be robustly interrogated as to why they felt it was okay. Lapse of judgment just isn't an answer. Or lapse of, you know, oh, it was just this. That if everyone took that attitude, we'd be in an awful state. You know, like I could have just said, oh, look, she'll just come over to the house and say, you wish me luck before I go in, and nobody will know. Well, it doesn't work like that, you know. And a lot of us are trying very, very hard. And I just feel it's set us back. It's set the morale back of the country. It certainly set my morale back this morning when I read it.
We had politicians who went to a golf outing, right? They were asked to resign. One of your own colleagues, Sean O'Rourke, was at the same outing, right? And RT were going to continue some sort of work with them, and that has discontinued. Yeah. So why is there one rule for one set of people and a different rule for the people who hold themselves in the high moral ground?
Ooh, not a lot of high moral ground around the place today, I can tell you. Now, not every caller into Joe agreed. Some felt it was an all too human slip, but not really. Here's Donal.
Everyone has an opinion, they're entitled to it. But the rules are the rules. We have something in place right now. And when politicians and judiciary and national broadcasters blatantly break the rules and are not held to account enough, some are held to account, some resign, but if they're not held to account enough, how on earth are we expected to have all the people of the nation, young and old, following the rules day after day after day? Show the example. You people, like yourself, Joe, and your colleagues and the politicians, judiciary, show the example 100% of the time, not 99% of the time. and just simply, let's break the rules, say we're sorry, move on. That's not good enough anymore. Okay. It's got to stop.
Ooh, live line on Friday. So yes, wash those hands, mask up and keep your distance. 2 metres, an actual 2 metres, not a Montrose 2. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Animals, they will keep eating, won't they? This week saw Dublin Zoo declaring that their beasts were eating them out of house and home. And without any income, because they don't have any visitors, they were in trouble. On Morning Ireland, Audrey Carvel spoke to zoo director Christoph Schwitzel.
In normal times, it costs about $1 million a month to run our zoo, Dublin Zoo, here. Of course, we've tried to make any cost savings possible during the pandemic, and we have achieved that. But, you know, there are limits. You can't furlough an elephant. You can't switch off a zoo at night when you go home. Our animals need and deserve 24/7 care, and we provide the highest standards of animal care and welfare possible. And so animal care alone costs us $500,000 a month, and these are very high fixed costs. And with no income from visitation, of course, we have difficulty meeting them.
You can't furlough an elephant, indeed. Leisure Drive Times' Della Kilroy visited Dublin Zoo and she spoke to Jerry Creighton, the operations manager.
So yeah, we're down at a Californian sea lion habitat. You can hear them calling out there. And this is one of the newer habitats at the Dublin Zoo. And these guys have a specialist diet where they get fresh fish that's brought up with vitamins added for them. And in the back, they've got their holding areas and their pools. But it's a very complex filtration system that needs to keep this pool at the levels that's required for Californian sea lions. And this is the kind of expenses that don't change all year round for the zoo.
How much would it cost to feed these animals?
They get a lot of fresh fish, which would equate to about maybe 300-400 euros per day. You know, as we move along and we've just left our sea lions, and next up is our flock of Chilean flamingos from South America. But they get a diet that's specially manufactured for them with a high content of shrimp and fish meal to give them that pinky colour. They eat quite a bit, you know, with 100 birds in the flock. Okay, we're just leaving the orangutans now and we'll head down towards the Asiatic lion family. They're specialist feeders too. A lot of good quality meats and poultry come up. It's absolutely human consumption quality meat. So everybody knows how expensive meat is, and that's delivered a couple of times a week. You know, the average lion would eat 50, 60 euros per day.
Oh, savages. But relief all round when the government committed to helping the zoo and also Photo Wildlife Park in Cork. And the public came up trumps, donating lots of money. So the zoo saved. But our relationship to animals can be a complicated one. Those we're happy to eat for food, baby lamb chops, so succulent and yummy. Those we're happy to wear, mink earmuffs, anyone for the week that's in it. And those we might be happy to kill for sport. Derek Mooney and co were grappling with the big questions. They spoke to wildlife conservationist Neil Beddy. And Neil works in South Africa, where trophy hunting is big business, wealthy clients paying large sums of money to kill game animals in a controlled setting. And Neil is working to study and protect white and black rhino. And while he's not a fan of hunting, he does see it as a necessary evil.
A lot of people don't understand how the whole system works. It's kind of maybe one of the things that's enlightened me greatly is arriving here and seeing ecotourism and then not being exposed to all the other mechanisms like game sales and hunting, but not understanding why it took 3 years before I started understanding the whole model of conservation here. And the main reason is because there's some parts of it's taboo. It's not ideal and people just don't understand it. But
it's a necessary evil is what you're saying.
Yeah, this whole
So in order for these reserves to survive, they've got to allow people to come onto the land and hunt big game.
A lot of places that, you know, they mightn't. It makes more business sense to do it because at the end of the day, you're the custodian of an entire landscape. It can't fail. You know, you need to think 100 years into the future and what that business model is going to look like. That's the idea of the reserve being developed, is to support biodiversity and conservation. So, I mean, if you're not going to employ all of these mechanisms available to you to support the landscape, then you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot, whether you like it or not.
Now, Richard Collins has been to game reserves on more than one occasion, but for him, there's an element of artifice. panto even.
I've been in them.
Yeah.
And usually the cantor sets out with the guide and the driver and they're going to search for the big five kind of thing. Yeah. And they sort of give the impression that, oh, it'll be, we'd be very lucky to see a leopard. Oh, we'd be very lucky if we came across some, maybe a white rhino, that sort of thing. And then they go out and they start looking at pug marks and then the tension rises. But I suspected... I'm a very cynical person, maybe, but I suspected that they knew hang well where the leopard was. We always managed to see a leopard. We always managed to see the rhino. We always managed to see the buffalo and the wildebeest. So it seemed to me that we're dealing here with a kind of a show. These fellows are good actors. So the impression created is that this is a kind of show. Is that accurate?
Well, it depends. It's called tourism for a reason, you know. Part of tourism is to be entertained. And you have to ask the question, you know, why are people going to these places? Are they going to these places because they want to protect wildlife? Or are they going to these places because they want to see the big five? You know, necessarily these animals don't need to see anybody and they'd probably be way better off if they never saw anybody. But we have this infatuation with nature because we are nature. And you have to understand that these are not just housing the charismatic animals that you've just mentioned. They're also protecting grass, they're protecting trees, they're protecting insects, small mammals, everything that we don't think about. These reserves have created an environment for them to live in, its habitat that was once agricultural land. For us as conservationists, it's all about compromise and understanding, you know, which is the lesser of the two evils. Ecotourism is imperfect, just as hunting is imperfect. But the fact of the matter is that's habitat that is supporting a wide range of wildlife. And that's what we need to remember.
Ooh, an interesting discussion with lots of grey, it seems. But then Derek and Richard got into it.
Are you happy going to a reserve to see animals where you know that in order to make a crust, they also allow fellas in to shoot the same animals?
Well, that's a moral question. Now, there's two sides to that. First of all, there is the impact that the shooting may have on the populations of animals. There may can be actions which don't lead to reduction damage to the population, which are nonetheless reprehensible. In other words, things that cause unnecessary cruelty or harassment or pain to the animals. Now, on the hunting...
It requires a simple yes or no, Richard.
It doesn't.
It does, because I asked you, are you happy going onto a reserve knowing that this is what's taking place? So yes or no?
Well, when I go out to the Irish Nature Reserve, the ducks are being shot and I have to accept that. I mean, death is part of life, and if the populations need to be culled, then of course it is acceptable. We are hunters. There is nothing wrong with that.
You wouldn't do it yourself. You wouldn't pick up a rifle and shoot a rhino.
Oh God, no, I wouldn't shoot anything. I don't. The whole idea is reprehensible to me.
Mooney goes wild on Monday. But if we're talking about creatures and entertainment, spare a thought for the flea. Here's Colette Kinsella.
Flea circuses used to use real fleas. And they weren't run by animal trainers. The circuses were operated by highly skilled jewellers and other craftsmen.
Watchmakers, in order to show off their skills, you know, who can make the most intricate tiny thing, would make tiny little harnesses for fleas and have them perform circus tricks.
These watchmaking ringmasters call themselves professors, and their flea performers were of the species Pulex irritans, the human flea, sourced from the professor's very own armpits or bed linen. And when you see the props they made for their stars to operate, farming equipment, tiny carriages, chariots, cannons, they truly are miniature masterpieces. And the performances themselves must have been exciting. Unless you're the flea.
Colette Kinsella burrowing down as heard on the series Animals. Well worth a listen, if you're not too scratchy afterwards. But Ryan Tuberty too had a story to make you twitch, and his involved rats. He read an email from a listener who told a story about Ryan's father, which showed him to be quite the cool customer.
As he was about to head home from work in John O'God's one evening, a patient met him at reception. And he said, "Dr. Tuberty, you need to watch out. I've just seen a large rat sitting in the back of the driver's seat of your car." And your father thanked him and said he'd check it out, thinking to himself, that guy must be a having delusions still, you're not well. Anyway, he subsequently went down to the car, and there, sitting on the seat, was indeed a rat. So he went back to the hospital, he asked a porter to come down with him to the car, and when they arrived, there was no sign of the rat. They examined the car thoroughly, but the rat appeared to have disappeared. Your father was perplexed and surmised that the porter felt he had been working too long as a psychiatrist and that he was now delusional. With no alternative, he got into the car, first pulling up his socks over his trousers and his collar up, and he drove home. Naturally, he was pretty shocked by this experience and was questioning his own sanity. He explained to your mother that what had happened, and she suggested that they put the car in the garage with the doors open and let the dog in, Red Setter called Ruskin, let the dog in. The dog went mad, and the remains of the rat were discovered in the engine. The rat was real and shredded, as it happens. This is a story I heard from my mother, says Patricia, in about the 80s sometime, and it certainly had the effect of making me check my car very thoroughly every time. I still have a vision of that rat sitting up on the back of the driver's seat, and it scares me.
Ooh, you'd be checking the back seat for the rest of your life. Meanwhile, over on Culture File on Lyric FM, botanical painter Jess Shepherd featured. She loves plants, even the freaky ones, for yes, there are such things.
With scientific illustration, you should never really depict any form of decay or if anything's been eaten or removed. And for example, if you're painting a tulip and you've got a freak that has 7 petals rather than 6, you should always try and make sure you have the 6, because that is how it should be. So with scientific illustration, you do need the science training, because you should have an awareness of how something should look and depict that. Whereas with this, I haven't done that. I've just painted what it is.
In all its decaying imperfection. And scale takes on a broader context when Shepherd blows up the image of a poplar leaf.
This leaf is almost as big as a human being. The veins do look like little roads or fields, as if you're flying an aeroplane or looking at Google Maps. I'm trying to almost make a mockery of our idea of scale, because in the natural world, there is no sense of scale. Things just exist, and it's a human thing. We have this necessity to measure all the time, and we will. But again, it's measuring things in relation to ourselves, putting ourselves in the middle.
A salutary reminder that perhaps it's not always about us humans. That was botanical painter Jess Shepherd, as featured on Culture File. Today is the centenary of Bloody Sunday, a day of violence etched forever in Irish history. Coordinated shootings by the IRA under Michael Collins left 14 dead, including intelligence agents and members of the British Auxiliary Force. Later that afternoon, Dublin played Tipperary in Croke Park, and in retaliation, British forces entered the grounds and killed 14 civilians, including one player, Michael Hogan from Tipperary. Bowman on Sunday brought us some eyewitness accounts of those events in Croke Park.
And the match was on about 10 minutes when we heard these bangs, but at that time, you think they were slap bangs, you know, we didn't know what it was until after a while we noticed everyone running towards the gates and shouting and screaming. There was no wall around Croke Park. Yes. It was a galvanised hoarding, yeah, of about, we'll say, about 8 feet higher. We rushed down the hill. You had to slide down the hill, down the back, you know, there was no steps or anything. We slide down and everyone, but everyone was trying to get to the gates out, and they were full, but we got to this galvanised, and some men there lifted us up and pushed us on top. We had to jump down over.
The first thing that struck us, we, those of us who had volunteer training, was to lay prone on the ground. And following that, a consolation voice, shouted out, "They're firing blanks." A minute later, it was obvious they weren't firing blanks. Sparks started flying out of the railway wall, and people started to roll down from the embankments, and it was obvious that people were getting shot. We lay still prone, and the backs, our backs, and the forwards, the Dublin forwards, rushed away from the firing end, from the canal end of it, and they rushed toward the railway exit. As the firing continued, both the Dublin Tipperary team decided to leave in pairs, lift automatically in pairs. Two pairs left. Hogan was in the third pair that got up to go, and as he did, he fell forward. I was within about 3 yards of him at the time, lay in the centre of the field, when, as he fell forward and fell to the ground, I saw the blood gushing from through his jersey, and he spurted up. I knew that he was shot and slipped across towards him and heard the words Jesus, Mary and Joseph from his lips. And I decided to rush for my life and try and get out.
Eyewitness accounts of Bloody Sunday as heard on Bowman on Sunday. On Tuesday, on Arena, Artistic Director of the Irish National Opera, Fergus Shiel, joined Sean Rocks for their series, Where Do I Begin? And for Shiel, it was all about German composer Richard Strauss.
I mean, Richard Strauss is one of these names I knew when I was younger, but I suppose I didn't fully grasp that he wasn't a relation of Johann Strauss and all the waltz people from Vienna. No relation at all, and his music is very different. When I was in college in Trinity studying music, I remember a lecturer put on a recording of the second of the four last songs, which were written in 1948, just right at the end of Strauss's life. And I remember just being totally mesmerised and perplexed by it because it was so complex and so luscious and so voluptuous. It was like you were immersed in a chocolate factory or something. It was so beautiful and almost like I couldn't believe that music could be that beautiful. You know, when you have one of those experiences that redefines for you exactly what the possibilities are, and that beautiful recording with Jesse Norman singing so beautifully, it really transfigured me. And I've loved Strauss's music ever since.
And in fact, it's the second, as you say, of the four last songs that we're going to hear this evening. Spring is the first, When Falling Asleep is the third, and At Sunset is the fourth. September is the one that you've chosen.
It was from the very end of his life. And obviously the imminence of death is something that is just over his shoulder, as it were, and it rears its head in many of the songs. But he's quite at peace with it. What you have in this is you have a lifetime of experience. It's like he's packed everything that he's ever learned throughout his entire life into it. And I would urge, if your listeners, turn up the volume, listen really carefully to like everything that's happening. It's like a whole dense forest of activity that's happening under that beautiful voice.
That is sublime. The music of Richard Strauss, the choice of Fergus Shiel, as heard on Arena. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Monday, Gabriel Byrne spoke to Ray from New York, no less. And Gabriel has written his memoir, and in it, he grapples with his self-image, particularly as a young fella.
Men of my generation were growing up thinking, oh God, am I blessed? Too big. Yeah. I thought at one stage, you know, I had my nipples were too prominent, and you know, this was never going to stop. And did I have hair on my chest? And I better cover up my chest because I've no hair. And I've got a bit of hair on the lower part of my back. That's right. Weird. What does that mean?
You'd a lot going on there.
Oh, a lot going on there for sure. And Gabriel's mammy was of a generation that didn't put a huge emphasis on self-esteem. Byrne talked about being interviewed at the launch of his film Defence of the Realm back in the 80s, and his mammy wasn't one to let him forget certain things.
You know, she'd kind of find some way to put you in your place. That was the job of the Irish mammy at that time. So I remember this public interview took place, and when I was 7 or 8 years of age, I made my first communion, and there was nothing spiritual or religious about it. All I did was line my pockets with money and then go to the shop and eat everything that I had not been able to afford before that. Crunchies, Texas bars, cream pies, Peggy eggs, butterscotches, Scott plans. Everything that I could put into me, I put in, washed down by Taylor Keith lemonade, and for the first time, Coca-Cola. Well, needless to say, that had a deleterious effect on the inside, and I lost control of them outside Delaney's at the end of our road, and I had to take refuge behind the wall there as nature took its course. And I didn't have the bottle to come out because it was kind of humiliating to be covered in, you know, the so anyway, eventually my mother found me, and without any judgment whatsoever, she put a coat over me and brought me home and never said anything about it. And so cut to this public meeting in
Galway,
in Galway, moderated by Lila Doolan. And she said, okay, well, let's open it out now to the audience. And I didn't know who was in the audience, but it was black out there. And they turned the light on, and Lily said, and, oh, yes, in the second row there. And my mother stood up, and she said, why don't you tell them about the time you got diarrhea and I had to come down and pull you out from Delaney's wall?
That'll put you in your place, that's for sure.
That puts you in your place, yeah.
Oh no, getting above your rear end there. That was Gabriel Byrne with Ray. Over on Lyric FM, Marty Whelan's missive from Well-Heeled Hugo was, well, vintage Hugo. And all you really need to know to enjoy this is that Marty is both the narrator and a blow-up doll.
Could you picture Marty Whelan in loungewear, not to speak of slobbing around? I have it on good authority that he dresses formally for dinner every night of the week. Don't we do that ourselves, said Daphne. Do we, love? I said. I can't say I've noticed. He's certainly not himself, said Mick. Look at him, he's sagging. He wasn't sagging last night, said Myrtle, nor this morning. He was quite turgid as we came downstairs together. I think he's leaking. I think he's leaking, said Heather. See how lopsided he's become. There's no hissing sound, said Myrtle. Do you think Marty Whelan has a slow puncture, said Mick. What? Said Myrtle, dropping her napkin and running around the table to her pride and joy. He's going down there like the sun in the evening, said Mick. Where do you think it is, the leak? Said Myrtle. Should we immerse him in a bath of water like he used to do with bicycle tubes, said Mick. I think it's his Achilles heel, I said. He's such an athlete, you know, said Myrtle. That wouldn't surprise me. Then she lost control as the puncture expanded. And Marty flew from her arms and did a high circuit of the room. Catch him, said Myrtle. Catch me, Marty Whelan, as he flies by. But he lodged on top of the chandelier, smiling down at us. He was always attracted to the bright lights, said Myrtle. Climbing onto the tip and taking a swing at him. Miss Myrtle, said Randy, coming in. Allow me, I'm used to getting men down from chandeliers. Be gentle, Randy. He's quite delicate. I don't want him maimed. I always take particular care of that, Miss M, he said. If necessary, I'll kiss it better. Leave that to me, Randy, she said. You can leave that to me. Yours truly, Hugh.
Oh, that was just deliciously silly. And another person perhaps getting giddy and jiggy with it is Talk to Joe, or in this case, Sing Along with Joseph.
Come to my house and just open the hall door. 24/7 in our house is Dermot Kennedy. We could be giants. That's all I hear. And I love him. I love him myself.
We used to be giants. When did we stop? Just say the word and I'll be yours. You know I never forgot.
This
is for you, Fiona. The hope and the herd.
Quite a nice voice, actually. Tuesday, it was rap, or something approximating rap. Inspired by caller Susan, who'd taken consumer complaints to a whole new artistic level with her rap, Rather Good, Joe then asked other callers to get in touch with their customer complaints so he could get his own rap on. Here's Patricia. What's the issue? Nah, doesn't really matter. Scatter, tatter, flatter.
Patricia, no. Who's the company? I need more names for rhyming purposes.
So the company was Fastway Couriers.
Fastway.
Fastway.
Lastway, Fastway.
And
it's not
I
a gasway. Today, no day. Where is Fastway? Monday, Tuesday. Where
Joe,
is Fastway?
I think you've got this covered. I think you've got it. Hopefully, I'll get
right.
My
okay.
Carson now.
Fastway, Fastway. What happened? Where are we now?
So basically, on the Friday, I emailed the customer service with Fastway, and I got an email saying it's on the van. It's going to be delivered.
It's on the van.
Yes.
It's on the van.
For delivery.
Susan.
It's on the van.
It's on the van. The van. The
with
transit
the
van. Where's my package from Fastway? It's on its way. We nearly ran. Instead, we put it on the transit van. Okay, go, Patricia, next.
So, Fastway delivery today, the 14th, I got an
14th.
Email.
I can't get out into rhyme with the 14th.
No, sorry, but again.
Okay.
Check the tracking information.
Tracking. Backing. Sacking. Macking.
Hacking.
Go ahead. So tracking
was delivered on the 20 past 12 on the 14th, which is Saturday.
Ah, you're not serious.
But I didn't deliver
because I was
here all day and there was no sign of it.
You do deliver. You do not deliver. You told me you do deliver. You might as well tell me you do deliver and the heart and the turkey, but you don't do deliver to me.
Joe Duffy, straight out of Compton, via Clontarf. That is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.